Turn your Bibles to John chapter 7. We're going back to the Gospel of John. It's been a while. Just so you know, if you're interested in these kinds of things, we're going to spend the next at least couple months through the end of June back in John, and then we'll see what happens. And we're going to try to get through the next next four chapters in the next 2 months because it serves as kind of a literary unit. And so you can read ahead each week if you want. We're in 7 today, and then we'll move on from there. I don't know that I want to go back and do a lot of what we've covered before, but just to say, like, I don't know if you were to ask somebody, like, what is, like, your favorite messages at Imago? One of my very favorite messages I've ever given was the last one I gave from John, and I know that probably nobody in the room remembers a word I said, but I loved it. And in fact, I was supposed to speak at a church a couple months ago, and it didn't work out, but I was going to do that message again because I loved it, but probably nobody remembers it. I kind of forgot about it. And then I was prepping this, and I was like, oh, that message. It was about Peter and Judas and the difference between them. And oh, it's good. I'm telling you, the message I gave was good. That's what I'm saying. Sorry. John chapter 7. We're just going to dive right in. I'm looking forward to this. After this, Jesus went around in Galilee. He did not want to go about in Judea because the Jewish leaders there were looking for a way to kill him. But when the Jewish festival of tabernacles was near, Jesus' brothers said to him, "Leave Galilee and go to Judea so that your disciples there may see the works you do. No one who wants to become a public figure acts in secret. Since you are doing these things, show yourself to the world, for even his own brothers did not believe him. Therefore, Jesus told them, 'My time is not yet here. For you, any time will do. The world cannot hate you, but it hates me because I testify that its works are evil. You go to the festival. I'm not going up to this festival because my time is not yet fully come.' After he had said this, he stayed in Galilee. However, after his brothers had left for the festival, he went also, not publicly, but in secret. Now at the festival, the Jewish leaders were watching for Jesus and asking, 'Where is he?' Among the crowds, there was widespread whispering about him. Some said, 'He is a good man.' Others replied, 'No, he deceives people.' But no one would say anything publicly about him for fear of the leaders." I want to pause there. That's a section, right? So you have a heading. Do you have a heading there in your Bibles, in your pre-Bible? So let's pause right there. And let's just spend a couple minutes with those verses. I was going to race past those because it seems like just a lot of details, but there's a couple juicy nuggets there. This is, if you're new with us, this is what we do now, is I'm going to stop talking and ask you, what did you see? What did you hear? What seemed interesting to you in the text? What? Joe's already on it. Yeah. Did Jesus lie here? You wrote that down? Jesus lied. The day Jesus lied. Oh, that's the sermon title. Sorry. Yeah. Then it accuses him of deceiving people. Yeah. It's a good question. Anybody have any thoughts? Yeah. He didn't go publicly. Technicality. Depends on what your definition of this is. Yeah. Okay, he went under the wire. They were wanting him to go in a public way. My favorite line in all of this is verse 4. No one who wants to become a public figure acts in secret. Secretly, I'm a very public figure. You don't know, like, duh. Sorry, I find it humorous. Nobody else does. Go on. Yeah. Yeah, so we get this idea up in the top, the first verse, that he doesn't want to go to Judea because Jewish leaders are looking for a way to kill him. And so there's this thing where the people seem a bit ignorant. And I'm going to get to the next passage where the people, like, call Jesus cray-cray. Like, nobody's trying to kill you, but they actually were. And so there's this thing going on where the religious leaders are now looking for ways to kill him. The people don't know it in the same way that they do. But there's also this undercurrent of, but some of them do, and so they're afraid to say things because they know. It's like, does that help? Trying to think of an analogy, and I don't have a good analogy of what that is. It's, they don't want to say things because they know that the leaders are predisposed against him. So there's kind of this, well, the leaders are against him, so we don't really want to talk about that. If there was an author I really liked and you all didn't, it'd be like, well, nobody likes this author that I like, so I'm not going to talk about that here because it'll just cause tension. And we don't, except the tension is that you might get killed for it. So it's a little intense. So there's no good analogies we have. What else? It's kind of snarky. So Jesus is a snarky and he's a liar here. Yeah. Yeah. I think so. I think it's the first. The disciples are called the brothers sometimes, rarely. But the phrase his own brothers seems to, in verse five, that seems to me to tip it towards his actual blood brothers. And so talk about that idea that his own brothers, so he has this following, a following of disciples, but then he also has a following in Judea going on, but then his own brothers don't even believe in him. What's that about? Yes! I was telling somebody yesterday, if I go back to Glassford, Illinois, I think I've told you this before. A couple years ago, I was in Glassford, where I'm from, and my mom asked me to run to the store, and all of a sudden, I got on my BMX and trucked it. No, I actually drove the car. But I walked into the store. I walked into the store, and the woman said, as soon as I walked in, she hasn't seen me in 30 years. You're one of the Dean boys. And I said, yeah, I'm Charlie. She goes, little Charlie, right? So like in Glassford, Illinois, despite the fact that I tower over my father and I could lay on him and he couldn't move, despite those facts, I will always in Glassford, Illinois, be little Charlie, right? And so you wonder if there's a little bit of that with Jesus' own brothers, right? So that it's like, you know, when I'm with my family, they don't think of me as the pastor of a church. I'm just older brother or son. You know what I'm saying? Like it's not... Jesus, I think, said something like, a prophet isn't accepted in his hometown. It's really hard to... When I was coming out of seminary, I thought about going back to my home church. And there was a lot of, like, should a pastor go back to his home church? Because you will always be seen as your high school self. And after having actually done that, I have mixed reviews. If you're ever thinking about that, I'll tell you what I think. It's good and bad. But, okay, one thing. Can I come back to you in just a second? What do we know about Jesus' brothers eventually? His blood brothers, at least one of them. What's that? He comes around in a big way. James becomes, James Jesus' brother, not James the disciple, James Jesus' brother becomes the head of the Jerusalem church. And he's the one in Acts 15 in the Jerusalem council that's opposition to Paul. So they come around. It just takes them longer because they have to get over, yeah, I knew you when you were a punk kid. Yeah. Yes, yes. You know, that's funny that you say that. I read that this week when I was reading it. That's the way I kind of read it. Like, they're poking at him. That line about, if you're going to be a public figure, you actually have to go out in public. Like, I read that as poking at him because they don't believe who he is, because there's some skepticism behind him, that they're trying to poke him and a little bit manipulate him. Which I think to me is the real nugget in this passage in verse 10. However, after his brothers had left for the festival, he went also not publicly but in secret. I don't think Jesus is lying. I don't think he's being disingenuous. Let me back up and give you a little bit of details about what this is. This is the Feast of Tabernacles. Anybody know anything about tabernacles? It's tents, yeah. So the other name for it is the Festival Booths. Booths, B-O-O-T-H-S. Or Sukkot. And Sukkot just means like temporary housing. So the idea is two things that were in play. One is it was at harvest time. And you built little houses or tabernacles. And during Feast of Tabernacles, you would actually take your meals in your little booth that you would build in your backyard or whatever. And it was to remind you that the people, the farmers out harvesting in the fields were living in temporary shelters too. That was one thing, to remind us of the harvest and to remind us to be thankful for the harvest. Secondly, though, it was to remind them of their time wandering in the desert where they lived in temporary structures. Does anybody know how modern Jews still reduce tabernacles? This is a picture of a modern day family doing festival booths, Sukkot. And so even today, many Jewish families will build a Sukkot in their backyard, and then they will take their meals for that week inside that little house. Some people then will sleep in that house all week long in their backyard, which I think for religious stuff, like, my kids would love this. Let's build a temporary house in the backyard and live in it for a week. Would that be awesome? I think. So, Gavin nodded at me. So we will at times in the next couple months as we work through this, there's things that happened in that festival that'll be important to our text. We'll come back to that idea. But the important thing to say is that it's one of three pilgrimage festivals that Jews were asked to come to Jerusalem for the observance of this. And so the idea that we're going down to Jerusalem for tabernacles would have been something many people would have done. So let me just do real quick to get back into John, a little bit of geography. So this is where Jesus is from. Galilee is up in the north part. See the Sea of Galilee there? That comes up into play in stories. And I underline some other places that come up in the Gospels quite a bit. Bethsaida, Capernaum, Cana, where the first miracle was, and then Nazareth, where Jesus was raised. Galilee, we've talked before, I think, in here about Galilee had a kind of a, it was a country, it was kind of remote, rural, right? And so there was different accents. 2 weeks ago, we were in Apalachicola, Florida. I think it's really just southern Alabama. And I went into a store and I was buying things and I was just talking to the cashier and she's like, "You're not from here, are you?" And I was like, "Well, I'm the one that talks for, right? Dummy." I didn't actually say that. She recognized that I wasn't from there just by the way I talked. You know how that happens? That would have been true of Galilee too. And we see that play out in the gospel story with Peter and his denials of Jesus, where it's like, you're one of them. You're a Galilean. So Jesus then, if you're a Jew in Galilee and you get to Feast of Tabernacles, you would have traveled down to the south to go down to Judea. See at the very bottom of the map, it says Judea. And then, so you would have traveled down. And so just so you know, as we work through stories in John, I underlined a couple places that are important. Bethlehem, Jerusalem. See, right above Jerusalem is Emmaus. Remember that story about the two men on the road to Emmaus? We'll get there eventually. And then Bethany, where he resurrects Lazarus in John 11, is there too. So that's kind of where we're at, right? So the push from his brothers, I think, is a bit manipulative. Right? I read it like you do, Eric. I read it a little bit. They're pushing, they're prodding, they're mocking him. They're trying to get him to go. And I don't think he's lying to them. I really just think it comes down to Jesus isn't going to do what he does on their terms. That's huge, right? So I have this thing in me. I don't know about any of you. I'll confess my thing. Ever have somebody tell you should do something? And you start to feel like I'm being manipulated, I'm being handled, I'm being managed by somebody? And there's everything in me in that moment that says internally, like, oh yeah, I have to, I should, you think I ought to? Like, there's something in, and it's not always good, right? It causes troubles for me in my life sometimes. But there's this thing in Jesus, and I think it's a good impulse here, where he is not allowing his brothers to manipulate his mission. And so there's two ways of seeing this. One way is to say Jesus is very much in control of who he's doing and what his mission is, and he's not going to let his brothers pressure him into entering down into Judea in a way that he doesn't want to enter. He doesn't want to go down with fanfare. He wants to kind of sneak in the back door. And so he's going to do it on his terms. So I don't think he's lying. The other way that some people interpret this is that Jesus responds first to their request with no, and then once they've left, and then once he's kind of discerned in his own spirit that this is what God is calling me to do, that he's willing to do that very thing. And I think that one's also interesting because it gives us freedom. It gives me freedom that sometimes we say no to something, and then sometimes it's just okay to change our mind. I think I've said this before here. We live in a culture where changing one's mind isn't acceptable. You're a flip-flopper, right? And yet sometimes wisdom and discernment is to say no and then to say yes. Or it is to say yes and then to back up and say no. And there's something maybe in here about Jesus being in tune with God and he's going out of his discernment what God is leading him to do and not just being manipulated by people. And I think there's a lot to be said about that idea in terms of our own, how do we make decisions? How do we go about living our life? What does it mean to discern what God is calling us to do and not be manipulated by other people saying, this is what you have to do? Is that good? At least something to process? Anything else to say about this passage, or can we turn? Verse 14. Not until halfway through the festival did Jesus go up to the temple courts and begin to teach. So the festival is about a week long, so he would have left about 3 days after his brothers. Not until halfway through the festival did Jesus go up to the temple courts and begin to teach. The Jews, and reminder from John, when he says the Jews, he actually means the Jewish religious leaders. That's what he means. The Jews there were amazed and asked, how did this man get such learning without having been taught? Jesus answered, my teaching is not my own. It comes from the one who sent me. Anyone who chooses to do the will of God will find out whether my teaching comes from God or whether I speak on my own. Whoever speaks on their own does so to gain personal glory, but he who seeks the glory of the one who sent him is a man of truth. There is nothing false about him. Has not Moses given you the law? Yet not one of you keeps the law. Why are you trying to kill me? You're demon-possessed, the crowd answered. Who's trying to kill you? Jesus said to them, I did one miracle and you're all amazed. Yet because Moses gave you circumcision, although it didn't actually come from Moses, but from the patriarchs, you circumcise a boy on the Sabbath. Now, if a boy can be circumcised on the Sabbath so the law of Moses may not be broken, why are you angry with me for healing a man's whole body on the Sabbath? Stop judging by mere appearances, but instead judge correctly. Thoughts, comments. Can I just tell you, by the way, when I read this the first time this week, I got done reading that and I went, I have no idea what any of that meant. You know, sometimes you read something and you're like, I don't even know what I just read. And I had to read it over and over and over and over because this is very Yoda-like, right? He's saying things that are a little bit like, what? And got to think about. What stood out? Yeah. Yeah, there's a little bit of that. He said, for those of you in the back, it felt a little mic drop-ish. Like, wah-ha! I'm out. Yeah. Yeah. So I was, in my notes, I wrote somewhere in here, in this mess of notes I have in front of me, the idea that you're demon-possessed, I think we need to, like, see that as almost like a euphemism. Like, you're crazy. Nobody's trying to kill you, except that he knows that there are people actually trying to kill him. And so, yeah, they vacillate between we believe you, but you're also crazy. We're not sure, back and forth. And understand different pockets of crowds would have different things going on. Yeah, Steve. Yeah. I'm going to come back to that because he's saying that about a very specific thing about how they judge him about the Sabbath and saying that they don't even judge him correctly in their assessment of him. And I want to come back to that here in a couple minutes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So they're a little bit of their arrogance, like you can't know what you know because we didn't tell you what we know. Like, and it's an accusation. You can read that and think it's not, but it is. It's like, what school do you come from? Who are you to stand up and tell us anything at all, is what they're actually saying there. And so it's an accusation. Yeah. Yes. That's good. Did everybody hear what Mary said? No? I got to recap that. The juxtaposition between them emphasizing we know what we know because it was passed us on to us by humans, and Jesus' defense here, and I'll say a little bit more about this in a second, or maybe I won't, I'll just say it now, is that one of Jesus' responses to their accusation is that, no, I know what I know because it comes from God. He's claiming, like, primary source, right? Again, mic drop-ish. Like, you know what you know because Rabbi such and such told you, I know because I know from God. Bam! Like, yeah. But it does highlight that he isn't claiming to have known what he knows because of them. He's claiming that he knows what he knows because of his communion with God. Yeah, John's gospel, compared to the other ones that are a little bit more earthy, in John's gospel, John has this awareness, or Jesus has an awareness of what's happening. And so even here, already in chapter 7, he's very intentional. And just so you know, just to give you framework, when he goes down to Judea in John's gospel here in chapter 7, he's not going back home ever again. And in fact, when we get through this little section that we're getting through, at chapter 11, we have the raising of Lazarus. In chapter 12, we're already in Holy Week. And so then the rest of the teachings from chapter 12 through 21 are all within the context of Holy Week. And so this is late in Jesus' ministry, and the way John portrays Jesus, at least, he has a clear idea that I'm going to the cross. And so he's pointing out here in this moment then their hypocrisy. You don't even follow the law, and yet you're judging me. You're going to kill me, and yet you don't even follow the law either. Yeah.
So Mary got me thinking about honor.
Yes. Yes. Did you all hear that? Did you guys hear that way back there? Holly, did you hear that? Good. Sorry, I wasn't meaning to, like, point. Did you hear that? That was for you. That was not what I was saying. Just, you're sitting away over there.
No, I was talking directly.
Can I pause for a second and just say, I've missed this. It feels like a long time since we've just been able to do this with the scripture, sit down and talk and have a conversation. I had a friend ask me last night. I was talking to a friend of mine, and she asked, she's like, are you excited to go back to John? I'm like, I don't really care what I preach on most weeks. It's fine. Like, whether we follow the lectionary or follow a book, I don't really care. I said, but what I am excited about tomorrow morning, I was saying this late last night, what I am excited about is sitting in the room with people and just kind of opening the scriptures and seeing what comes out of it. That's fun for me. Anything else? But no pressure. So one of the things that we're up against in this section of John's gospel is this question of authority. You may not remember, but we've come up against it before. In John 5, Jesus does a healing, and it's a healing of a blind man, and we're told in that passage that it was a healing done on the Sabbath. And I don't know if you remember, but it's a very specific question then that they ask, on what authority do you heal on the Sabbath? And Jesus responded then, you know, basically on God's authority. And so this is more of that. And we're going to run up to this theme because John's trying to paint a picture and show us how Jesus gets from great teacher to crucified. And so he's going to work through some of these things. So by what authority, basically what they're asking in that whole thing about how did this man get such learning without having been taught, this is the heart of their question then, is by what authority do you say and do the things that you say and do? And I don't usually do lists, but I think it helped me when I started taking this passage apart and started seeing this as a list, that Jesus essentially, I think, has five responses. The first one is verse 16, and I don't know that we need to spend a lot of time here unless you have questions, but his first response, how did this man get such learning without having been taught, is what Mary said. Jesus, first of all, says, I'm not dependent upon your level of schooling. It's not your schools of thought that I'm depending on. What I'm saying actually comes from God, and I think tying all that together is really beautiful. I'm teaching about the heart of God. I'm not teaching about how to follow the rules. So if you understand how rabbinic thought developed, there's the rules, and then the way rabbinic thought works is then there was the oral tradition that surrounded the rules that said if the rule is don't cross the street, then rabbinic tradition would have said like, okay, then in order to keep ourselves from accidentally crossing the street, we ought to stay 10 feet back from the street. And so the rule now becomes stay 10 feet from the street, and if you step into that space, now you're violating the oral law. And so that's what Jesus is coming after and really going back to, wait, we got to get to the heart of what it was about, not crossing the street, not the rules. And so so then he's claiming that his teaching comes from God. The second thing that I think Jesus is doing to answer the accusation is in verse 17. And I really love this one, and I'm going to say some things about it, and then I want to come back to it at the end and look at it again. He says, read this slowly, anyone who chooses to do the will of God will find out whether my teaching comes from God or whether I speak on my own. I think what Jesus is after here is the people who really want to follow me, it'll resonate inside of them. Have you ever had this moment where, for me sometimes, it's often reading books or I meet a person and we start having a discussion and I'm introduced to a new idea or a new way of thinking about something, but there's something intuitive in you that just goes, this is a new idea, but it seems to be true. You ever have that? Like maybe you're sitting sometime in a sermon and you hear somebody say something and you're like, that's a new idea and I need to check that out further, but something inside of me is just saying that feels true. That person, have you ever met somebody and you don't even really know enough about them to say this, but you're like, there's something about them that just feels authentic. And I think that's what Jesus is saying here. One of his defenses about what's your authority is Jesus says, the true followers of God will resonate with my message because my message comes from God. There'll be some resonance there. They will just get it in a way that other people don't. That happens with like a lot of things, right? Like sometimes we just resonate. Like have you ever had this thing where you read a book and it just resonates deeply in you and then you hand it to somebody else and they're like, meh. Or an album that like you read, you're like, oh, this is the most amazing music I've ever heard. And then somebody else listens to it and they're like, I think it's kind of dumb. You know, why are they using the keytar? Thirdly, Jesus' defense of himself. Verse 18, I think, here. Whoever speaks on their own does so to gain personal glory, But he who seeks the glory of the one who sent him is a man of truth. There's nothing false about him. Again, one of those things we need to read slowly, but I think what Jesus is talking about here is that there's an internal credibility of my message, that my message is not coming out of my own desires. I'm not trying to manipulate you with the words I say. Again, going back to this, have you ever felt manipulated by somebody that person's up there saying that thing, but okay, this is the worst extreme. Have you ever been watching television preachers and you know they're talking about God, but you also know that really what they want you to do is call in and give them the $10 of seed money, right? Like, you know that there's a message that they're giving, but it's not the real message. The real message is send your money. And I think what Jesus is saying here is that there's an internal credibility to my message. That you know it's true because I'm not manipulating you. I'm not using what I'm saying to try to get you to do a certain thing or put you in a certain light. There's an internal credibility. Four, I'm going to hurry through these. And then he gets in this thing then. This is great. So then he says, why are you trying to kill me?